Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thanks to Scott for coming in today, and thank you so much for listening in. And if you have a wildlife question or a comment, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. If you got a picture or a question, I hope you'll post it on our Facebook page as well. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can do that. And Scott, great to have you back.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm feeling a little discombobulated and jet-lagged and assorted other things, but it's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And, you know, just in time, spring's here, you know?
Spring is this is a busy time of year. For anybody interested in the outdoors and wildlife or working in it professionally like I do, everything all of a sudden starts within a matter of a couple of weeks, and the winter damage that happened is exposed. The birds are back. The turkey season opens. The Conservation Congress meetings are held. There's just a lot of stuff going on. So that's good.
There's a lot. And as I walk over from my other office to the radio station, there are two male cardinals that differ about a block and a half apart from each other that are just singing like crazy.
Well, that's a good thing. And that's the nice thing, too. In the spring, fall is kind of the hunting season, mm-hmm. and that's what the wildlife activity revolves around. But in the spring, mm-hmm. that's not the case. And everybody has a chance to get out there and enjoy all the breeding and courtship activity of the birds. And it's just lots of activity and things to see and hear.
Absolutely. And hear. It's really wonderful. 5:30 in the morning, 5:45 in the morning out there where it's quiet. And the birds, it's like a chorus out there. It's beautiful.
It was pretty nice yesterday morning planting tomato plants in a garden, too. But that was in Long Beach, California.
A little different. Just a little different. Well, did you see any, notice any, or have you heard about any winter wildlife problems?
The usual. I mean, this obviously snow's gone here in southern Wisconsin, except for a few patches on the northern exposures. But it's slowly going from the northern part of the state. But as it goes, usually the kinds of things that people have been calling about are the runways left in the grass by vole activity. Yeah. The gnawing on the woody shrubbery and ornamental plants by rabbits and deer and voles and other such things that are simply things that are invisible when they're covered by snow, and then all of a sudden people see them and say, oh my gosh, what's happened? What can we do? And unfortunately, the what's revealed in the spring is more of a warning notification mm-hmm. that, hey, next fall, better do some things or take some steps to prevent this from happening again next winter, because once the damage is revealed, it is what it is. It's there, and there's not much that can be done about it. But it is a bit of a wake-up call that, boy, next fall we better do something about vole control. We better fence the shrubs. We better do this or that, make sure the soffits are intact or things will get in the attic. And that's all good, too. And it's a chance to renew and plant and get the gardens in and think about your landscaping and how that might relate to your interests in wildlife and all sorts of things.
Yeah, and you're going to be busy. Is it this weekend you're talking about bats? I wanted to get that in before I forgot about it.
Well, yes, that's true. This coming Saturday, the 9th, I'm doing a couple of seminars out at Wild Birds Unlimited on the west side of Madison, and those are at 10 and 11:30. I know the first one's full. I think the second one still may have some openings in it. But I think 25 or 30 people, and we spend an hour or so talking about all things bat. And white nose syndrome, of course, is still a big issue, so we'll talk a little bit about that. But the big thing to talk about is that a week from Saturday, on the 16th, at the sessions this Saturday, I'll be promoting the first ever Wisconsin Bat Festival, which will take place on Saturday the 16th, as I mentioned, at the Lussier Family Center out on the southwest side of Madison. And that should be a lot of fun for everybody. I've got a couple of notes here. As I say, it's the first ever, but there are lots of activities throughout the day. There are door prizes. There'll be food. You build your own bat house. A TV personality by the name of Rob Meese, or I believe it is, will have demonstrations at 11, 1, and 3, and he has bats of the world, so he'll have live bats with giant fruit bats and vampire bats and all sorts of neat stuff live. So the whole thing runs from 10 to 4 at the Lussier Center, which is in Lake Farm Park. Right
beautiful
off the Beltline, not very far from your place. It's a beautiful spot. There's plenty of parking. Kids are free. Otherwise, it's an $8 admission, but you get some stuff to take home and see some neat stuff, and it's a fundraiser for bat conservation here in Wisconsin. My Great. Former student, Dave Riddell, who's the bat ecologist mm-hmm. with the DNR, is involved in this, and as well as a lot of people on his team, and he's anxious to raise some money for bat conservation in these days where money's hard to come by otherwise. Yeah. So if you're interested in bats and you're in the area or coming into the area, the first ever bat festival, 10 to 4, Saturday the 16th, out at Lake Farm Park. Good place to be.
Good place to be. Gloria Inshano has a question or comment for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Gloria.
Good morning.
Thanks morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an odd situation. We live in an area where we have farmland on three sides of us, and the Menominee Reservation is our north boundary. So we see a lot of animals out here. But about 2 years ago, we had a pair of rats move in the winter. I feed tons of birds. There's all kinds of bird seed out there.
Uh-huh.
And my husband dispatched them as soon as we saw them, but it was already too late. They'd apparently started breeding.
Uh-huh.
Now we have rats in three different areas, and my son says he's seen a forest down by the edge of the woods, which is where our chicken coop is.
Uh-huh.
This last winter, to our extreme delight, I had called the exterminator last fall, but it snowed before we could do anything.
Uh-huh.
We had an ermine right outside the kitchen window. We were able to see him like three times, and he's apparently going down these rat tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, the other day, we saw him again. He was about 10% brown, and the rest was white. It was interesting to see how he blended in with the snow and the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is he eradicating those rats, or is he living in their tunnel?
Well, he's certainly living in the tunnels. I mean, rats are great burrowers, and they do create quite a tunnel system, and it is often around chicken coops or grain yeah. bins or places like that. And then those tunnels, in turn, provide habitat for a variety of snakes and other small mammals and so forth. You know, the rats actually probably outweigh the ermine 2-1. But on the other hand, an ermine, being a member of the weasel family, is a ferocious little bugger, and I would give them credit for being able to take down a rat. On the other hand, a rat's got a pretty impressive set of incisor yeah. teeth. So I guess I wouldn't want to be in the tunnel if the rat's going one way and the ermine's going the other way and they confront each other. But I think it's quite possible that certainly the young rats are vulnerable to the ermine and possibly even the adults. So the ermine's probably doing you some good.
Okay.
The difficulty then, in terms of setting traps for the rats, is that you don't want the ermine to be bycatch of your trapping operation.
Well, that's my problem. I don't want to take the weasel out, but we've got to get rid of these rats.
Well, you know, the rats are as good as they are at burrowing. They're equally effective at climbing, and you might be able to find a place, say, in or on the chicken coop or around there where you could elevate the traps. That's not to say that the ermine might not get up to them, too, but if you use peanut butter and put a little piece of cloth rag on the trigger, tie that on tightly and then smear the peanut butter into it so the rats have to tug on it a little bit, you'll catch the rats easily enough, and you may be able to avoid the ermine. The problem is if you have exterminators come out, you know, they're going to trap as well, or they may put some rodenticide down the burrows, and that may be equally problematic for the ermine. So you may have to take a little risk here, but I urge you to get on top of the rat issue quickly and vigorously, because as you've already pointed out, once they start to reproduce, the reproductive potential of a pair of rats is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's from one pair of rats with unrestricted, I'm trying to think back now to teaching the mammalogy class, I think the reproductive potential from one pair to over 3 years with unrestricted complete survival, which of course doesn't happen, is something yeah. like 350 million potential offspring. So the issue is they have litters of 9 to 12. They have a litter every 3 months. The young can reproduce when they're 3 months old. You need to get on top of them and be careful of the ermine, but you need to do something about the rats.
I had a friend who had that same problem, had a chicken coop and a feed bin mm-hmm. within 100 yards of the house, and when the chickens in the feed bin went away, the rats went away. He had no more problems. They'll go away if you eliminate the food source.
If you can, you know, if you can eliminate, of course, that means you may have to shut down the chicken coop for a while or do some things you don't want to do. But Larry's right. If you can eliminate the attraction, which is a food source and some shelter, then they will head out.
They'll go. Good luck, Luria. Thank you for calling. Vicki and Racine, we're on to you. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I have another question about a member of the weasel family. I was out at our local kennel club with my puppy for puppy class, and there was a animal running around in the parking lot that looked like a mink, and it was acting real strangely because it was chasing the cars, and it was following people with dogs whenever it could, and people were trying to avoid it because everybody thought it must be sick and have some kind of a disease. Can you tell me what might have been wrong with this? We eventually called the police, and they came out and shot it because we were afraid it was going to bite somebody.
Was it, in fact, a mink?
As far as I can tell from looking in my animal books, it looked like a real large weasel, but it didn't have a bushy tail.
What color was it?
Kind of a medium brown color, all uniform color, small ears.
Okay, well, I mean, it certainly sounds like a mink from the description, but sometimes the possibilities when an animal's behaving weird like that, in other words, is actually seems to be attracted to people or whatnot, the other member of the weasel family that's in some ways, unfortunately, fairly common are pet ferrets, which are the same size, same shape, but generally more of a lighter color with darker extremities. So I think you would have noticed that.
I've never seen a ferret this big. This thing was at least 2 feet long.
Well, I can't tell you what might have affected it. Injury, disease, it's difficult to say. I had a similar experience in Sheboygan a few years ago when we were getting ready to go out on a charter boat fishing. There was a mink along the wharfs, and it was just kind of loping along back and forth in and out of the storefronts and looking at people and behaving very strangely, and ultimately it got under a building and we couldn't get it. We assumed it was in some way sick and debilitated, uh-huh. and its judgment was obviously impaired. So I can't tell you for sure what was wrong, and the only way to have determined that after the police had dispatched it would have been to kind of get it into the system through either your veterinarian or the DNR Wildlife Health people and see if a necropsy would have turned something up. Be it parasite or disease or mm-hmm. physical injury. So we can only speculate on that, but it does sound like it was a mink. And under circumstance, go ahead.
I was afraid that it might pass something on to the dogs because it was at the kennel club.
Yeah.
Or rabies.
That's always a concern. That would be a bit unusual, but you never know. That, too, is a possibility.
Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, our guest today here on the Ideas Network. Scott, there's a video out there, kind of a movie-like thing called Pig Bomb. Is that right?
Well, it's actually a one-hour kind of documentary or special that's been airing on TV.
I haven't seen it yet.
I think on either the Discovery Channel or History Channel, one or the other. And it's been on quite a few times. It's just called The Pig Bomb. And it's essentially a documentary of the growing and very serious, I mean, even scary problem of feral pigs, particularly in some of the southern states, Florida, Texas, California, places like that. But, of course, remember, we were pretty concerned about feral hogs in some areas of western and west central Wisconsin a couple of years ago, and there are probably still a few around. But in the areas where the pigs are firmly entrenched, it is just a horrific problem. I mean, thousands of them. And they're very prolific. They're very incredibly destructive, dangerous. And it's just virtually proven almost impossible to get on top of them, even though they provide some hunting opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think the statistics are that you need to remove at least 70% of the population annually by hunting or some other form of removal just to stay on top of just to keep them more or less stable. And that's a Herculean task. So that the pig population is burgeoning, and as I say, they're incredibly destructive. There was also a video circulating on the internet the other day of someone up in a tree stand with a video camera, And it just said, well, here come the pigs. And this herd of feral pigs started coming through the woods. And they looked like a swarm of ants in the tropics.
Oh, man.
Hundreds and hundreds of them. So it's kind of a scary thing. But if it does nothing more than raise public awareness that this feral pig issue is a really serious one, and that we're actually pretty darn lucky here in Wisconsin that it's only been a spotty or somewhat erratic problem that we've been able to stay on top of, when you get into some other parts of the country, it is a huge conservation issue.
Yeah.
So it's called the pig bomb. Don't miss it.
The pig bomb. I definitely am going to look that up. Jeanette in La Crosse has a question or comment for you. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. A friend of mine named Bruce, he built me two squirrel boxes. And over the last couple of years, they fill up with dirt. And I don't know, is it because of the, when they put the leaves and stuff in there for nesting, does it turn into a topsoil? Or, and if so, how often do you clean that out? Because there was like 6-8 inches of soil in this box. It was the weirdest thing. And I dug it all out with my hand last fall. And I'm just thinking if you could comment on that.
Well, first of all, I'd be really careful sticking my hand in a squirrel box, lest there be a squirrel in there. But if you can pick, squirrel boxes are like any other nesting structure. Routine maintenance and cleanliness is a good idea. So if you can pick a time when you know the squirrels are not reproducing in there, and they probably are now, and I'm thinking probably late fall going into the winter season, or before there's any sign of reproduction, or if you see a litter head out and it looks like there's a little downtime and they will have another litter midsummer, then, go ahead and take the box down. And if the boxes already aren't constructed, kind of like a bluebird box where there's either a hinge on one wall, or sometimes one wall is only attached on one side and then there's just a loose nail that holds it in place so that you can swing one wall out or swing the top off, and then essentially dump it out, the squirrels are quite capable of bringing back whatever nesting material they want, either for winter warmth or for another nesting attempt. And it helps to clean it out anyway, because in all that debris, there'll be parasites that the squirrels would just as soon be free of, and potentially pathogens and other things that you don't want. So clean it out periodically and give the squirrels a little break.
There you go.
Can I ask you to comment on something else?
Sure.
I'll hang up and listen, but can you comment on that wonderful Decora Bald Eagle webcam?
I'm just making a note here. I'm not familiar with that particular one, but I saw as I returned from California this morning, my email box was runneth over, and there was one that was a summary of some of the wildlife webcams that are available right now. It's a common thing to do in the spring. In fact, if it's not already up, we've been working with the engineering department to get a webcam on a red-tailed hawk nest that's on the geology building for the second year now. So there'll be another one joining the mix, but usually they're focused on a nest or a nest structure, and you can watch the whole nesting cycle. So I don't know about this one in Decora. Are you still on, Jeanette?
Yeah, I
watched it.
Oh, you've seen that one, Larry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, there's an eagle on the nest.
Yeah, so they're all...
Last I saw, two of the eggs had hatched. I don't know if the third one ever did or not. Larry might know.
Don't know. I didn't see.
My general advice is, I think if you do a little Google searching, or in this case, maybe Google
Decor.
Shoot
me an email, or shoot that to me in an email. We'll post it on my Facebook page. Let's see here. It might already have been done. I'll have to check.
So we'll try and post that, but I guess I just urge all the listeners watching these webcams, whether it's a webcam over an African waterhole or a webcam on a Wisconsin eagle nest or anything else, it's a pretty neat way to get some insight into the behavior and nesting cycle or reproductive cycle of all these animals. So
and Judith's just letting me know that Chuck just emailed and said, two eaglets so far, one more egg ready any minute.
Any minute. Well, log on, folks.
It's www.ustream.tv/Decora Eagles. And we'll put that up on our Facebook page. Oh, got it right now. Judith's already caught it. So go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can go right to it.
So the technology of the webcams is pretty cool, and the technology of finding the webcams is even cooler.
Thanks a lot, Jeanette, for calling. Appreciate your call. And an email from, oh, my goodness. Oh, well, yeah, let's read this. John and Patricia in Dousman would like to ask you how you feel, Scott, about the massive early retirements that are going on in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And about the new DNR secretary, we've heard and read a lot of negative things about the new secretary. Are extremely worried about the future of wildlife in the state of Wisconsin. So here I am putting you on the spot.
Well, first of all, with regard to the retirement wave, I can only say that it's not just the Department of Natural Resources. The university and a variety of other state or public organizations are also feeling the same thing. We have a number of people leaving my department, including me. I mean, I might as well. It's no huge secret. I'll be retiring here at the end of the fiscal year in June. But the good news is, I guess, from the standpoint of Larry's and my relationship, I'm going to continue doing the radio program for the foreseeable future. So that will be seamless. But a lot of folks have decided to retire for a variety of reasons. And the fact that there are so many suggests that there's something kind of fishy going on. And, you know, anybody who reads the papers knows what's going on. So that's no secret. The problem, of course, is that the people who are leaving are, of course, the people like me who have,
in my case,
32 years as a faculty member and 39 years on campus. And that's true of both the agency people, the university people, and everybody else. So there are hundreds and hundreds of years of experience walking out the door, so to speak. Some of those folks will continue to be active in conservation as volunteers, and some of them will continue to help out their former employers and so forth. So it won't be a complete break, but it certainly will be a loss of expertise, and it's very much unclear how many of us will be replaced and when. Mm-hmm. That may take a while. Or it may not happen at all. We just don't know. And I don't know, so I can't really speculate on that except to say that, like you, I also am concerned about the loss of expertise and some really good people moving on. So having said that, there are a lot of good people left behind. It's not like everybody's leaving. So there are a lot of great people in all these organizations, and they'll continue to do the work and rise to the challenge. And on the bright side, the departures are making room for lots of sharp young people who have been waiting for a chance to get in. A lot of them produced right here on campus. And to see some of those young folks get jobs over the next few years will be great. As far as where things are headed, I can't really tell you very much about that. As far as the DNR secretary or anybody else who's coming into positions of leadership, I think it's really kind of early to make an absolute judgment. From what I've heard, people are at least listening and talking to other people and getting around the state to hear from. I know most of the administrators have been on tour around the state listening to the concerns of local and regional people. And seem open to that. Ultimately, what will happen on a policy basis will in some ways be determined by what kinds of financial resources are available. So I guess I just have to say that the jury's still out on a lot of this in terms of which way things are going to be headed. And the next event that will occur that will at least point in the direction of some of those policies will be the Statewide Conservation Congress spring hearings coming up this coming Monday.
Yeah.
April 11th at 7 o'clock. There will be one in every county in the state. And there are lots of advisory questions on there on all sorts of conservation issues, some large, some small, some local, some statewide, some fish, some wildlife, a whole bunch of stuff. And those hearings, despite the fact that a lot of the material covered does deal with fishing and hunting, there are still some things on there that are important to everybody who's interested in conservation, and anybody who's interested in conservation is welcome to attend. I realize there's been lots of, you know, we've been doing this program for a long time, Larry, and every time this comes up, there are concerns that, oh, it's just a hunter's gathering. But in fact, different topics have brought in different types of crowds, and if you everybody's free to vote on the ballot on the various advisory questions, and whether it's got something to do with increasing the overwinter goals for deer or expanding the opportunities for youth hunting or deer baiting and feeding, which is a concern, to everyone. Those kinds of things are on the ballot, and everybody's free to go and have their voice heard. So that's coming up this coming Monday, the 11th, and that's one of the things that will direct some of the policy decisions that are made. The rest of them, we'll see what happens.
That's a pretty good answer right off the top of your head. Thanks, Scott. And thanks for that question, John and Patricia. Let's go to Lisa in St. Germain. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. For years, I've had a problem with flying squirrels in my attic space. 2 years ago, we did some remodeling and tore down the ceiling. They had burrowed through all the insulation, got rid of all of it. Half of the space we put in a vaulted ceiling. The other half is another flat ceiling with just a little bit of an attic space. Thought we got rid of them, and they were back again this winter. I stopped feeding the birds, thinking maybe that was part of their food source, and they're still here. And I know they're a protected species, and I don't know if that applies to an infestation, but how do we deter these little critters from coming in?
Well, I think in the case of an infestation, you can deal with them by whatever means, but if you're concerned about that, that's one of those things in the case of controlling animals, especially when they have some degree of protection. I simply, as a matter of course, recommend that you run that past the local conservation officer. They appreciate knowing what's going on, and just in case there are any issues, it can be resolved up front rather than after the fact. So that that can alleviate your concerns there. As far as dealing with them, the remodeling bodes well, because one would assume that the roof and the soffits and the building as, you know, as a whole is pretty solid and tight right now. Nevertheless,
they got in anyway.
They're getting in somewhere.
Yep.
So that requires a very thorough inspection to figure out where that hole is. And it, you know, it's not going to be the size of a dime. It's got to be quarter sized or bigger. So the likely places are flashing around the chimney, soffit vents, access for utility cables or pipes that may not have a guard on them, or literally a hole that the animals have excavated at a joint or a peak or where a roof line joins the wall or some place like that.
Okay.
And if you find it, then most people, flying squirrels are cute little buggers. They're really attractive little animals, and it's too bad that they do cause problems in buildings, but they do. They are a squirrel and a rodent nonetheless.
Well, they ceased being cute years ago.
Well, I understand that. And if you can find the access, then there are the Tomahawk Trap Company and perhaps others. Tomahawk Traps are right up in northern Wisconsin. They make a little spring-loaded door device called a squirrel excluder. And if you find the hole, you get one of these, and then you mount it to the wall over the hole just by stapling it on the wood. And it's a spring-loaded door, so the flying squirrels or any other squirrel can push their way out under this little door, but it drops shut behind them, and they can't get back in.
Okay.
And that would allow you to get them out and then make some permanent repair. And then you'll need to be very vigilant to make sure that they don't reopen another hole or find another way in. And the bird feeding issue, sure, they'll use a bird feeder, but I think they're much more interested in a secure home site or den site than they are the food you're providing. So I think you can feed your birds and still exclude the flying squirrels.
Now, will they seek housing elsewhere come the warmer weather, or do they still want to be inside?
They still will use a den site, especially if they're breeding up there, and they will also, like the gray squirrels, have two litters a year, so you have to watch out for that, too.
Okay.
And, I mean, squirrel breeding's been well underway now for a while. So be a little cautious of that, but yes, the bottom line is they may spend more time outside in the warmer weather in the evenings, but they're still, if that's their home den site, they will still use it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There you go. You mentioned breeding going on, and Rick had emailed and wondering about animals having their young. He was thinking about, like, deer and bear and perhaps Canada geese. How many are in a typical litter? This is the time of year.
Everybody's breeding out there, Larry. It's unbelievable.
It's an orgy going on out
but
there.
But the a lot of the breeding itself took place last fall for things with a long gestation period. For deer, it's around 200 days, so the breeding was during the rut last October and November, and the peak of fawn drop is around the 1st of June, late May, 1st of June, depending on where you are in the state. So some of those young are yet to come, although I've, over the years... See, this is one of those things with, people who have been around a long time. We've had thousands of calls, and I remember one person, and I'm pretty sure it was from Maple Bluff, reported finding twin fawns in her tulips, and I think it was like April 15th or 16th. So all of these things have a somewhat normal distribution statistically. Yeah. So they're early ones and late ones. So even though I say fawns are dropped around the 1st of June, you could find a fawn in April. You could find a fawn in August. The bear cubs have already been born in the den. Whether they're out of the den yet or not is questionable, depending on how spring weather's going. A lot of the early nesting birds, in fact, I've got an email question here we'll get to from the Nature Mappers about raven nesting, which occurs in February. The horned owls we were talking about 2 months ago. Yeah. A lot of things are already born. And as far as Canada geese are concerned, they're already nesting here in southern Wisconsin. I've been getting calls about duck nests in unwanted places. So it's well underway, and it will continue well underway until all these wildlife populations by early to midsummer reach their annual peaks. Yeah. And then things will start to tail off again through next winter. So
there you go.
Right, but the good news is, all that breeding activity has all these neat stuff along with it, like the cardinals singing that you were talking about, or turkeys strutting now with turkey season opening next week, and the grouse are drumming, and the pheasants are crowing, and there's just all sorts of neat stuff out there.
Absolutely. Let's go to Michael in Washburn. Hi, Michael.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
The maple sap is flowing strongly in Mayfield County, and... in addition to getting the good sweet stuff, so far I've run into the biggest bobcat I've ever seen and had a wolf howl at me up close and personal.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. Scott knows approximately where I live. If you'll remember, he was here for lunch one day.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember it very well. Nice place.
Nice. It's very nice this time of year. One question, but first I want to put in a plug. I just met Darren Miller down at the Levoit Hatchery down on 13 between Washburn and Bayfield the other day, and he gave me some brochures. As you recall, Judy and I have a program, and they have a great youth day in June. I don't know exact date yet. I don't think he's got the specific brochures out, but he gave me one from last year, and it's just an excellent program for any age. There's fly tying workshops and shirt printing workshops, and of course they get to fish in some of the big tanks, and for the trouts, some of the splake and browns and stuff they have in there, and they also have a little archery range set up and food, and so I just wanted to put in a plug for that. It's an excellent program.
Great.
And it's also available to schools and so on through the year. My question is, Pat Quaintance ran into me the other day and at the Leno's BP in downtown Washburn, which is the social mecca of our town. And he asked if he could put a bear bait on my property. I said, sure. And it's apparently for population studies and range and so on.
Oh, yes.
You have spoken about that before in program, I know. And what is it that they put in the peanut butter? Was it an isotope or something?
Well, before, they've switched to peanut butter. When they did this before in 2008, this is this statewide or pretty much bear range-wide study to determine the bear population. And we talked about it a lot. They took little wooden boxes and filled them with bacon at that point, laced with tetracycline. And then these were put in a grid pattern across northern Wisconsin. And then after they determined, how many boxes were hit or not hit by bears, then the bear hunters submit a piece of a rib bone during the fall from the bear harvest. Mm-hmm. And the tetracycline in the bait actually causes a bit of staining on the bone. And then the researchers can look at the bones that are stained and unstained, the boxes that were hit and unhit, and with a little higher mathematics, come up with a very interesting ratio that gives a pretty tight estimate on the bear population. And back in 08, that's when all of a sudden you say, holy moly, we got a lot more bears than we thought we had. And as a result, they're replicating that this year and I believe next year to further refine that bear population estimate. And for whatever reason, they decided that I think it was peanut butter and maybe peanut butter and, I don't know, something else in there too, yeah, was going to be more appropriate. Maybe it's just the price of bacon. I don't know. But nevertheless, they're using peanut butter.
And are they still using the same chemical?
I think so.
Okay, okay. I was unclear on what they were using on that. So, well, that'll be very interesting, and we certainly have a lot of bears. Just one more quick question. What is the estimated population of bears in the state of Wisconsin right now?
Well, the range back in 08, we were kind of moving on a figure that we were in 15,000 bears, give or take, and then that estimate came in, and I think it was a range of something like 26,000 to 40,000, and I think they settled on something maybe in the 30s. So roughly at least twice as many as we thought we had, and maybe more.
Okay. That's a lot of bears. And a good number of them are right here in Wisconsin.
It's a lot of bears.
Scott, it was nice talking to you again.
Thanks,
Michael.
Have
a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call.
The maple syrup thing, I mean, it's not a wildlife issue, but I've always been fascinated by making syrup. And flying back on the plane yesterday, I can't remember what magazine it was in, but there was an interesting account of a new tactic, you know, boiling this very weakly concentrated sap is a lot of effort. But now they've got a reverse osmosis technique that sucks the water right out of the sap and concentrates it and makes it much easier to make the syrup. Good idea.
I read that same piece. We actually did a show last week on maple syrup, and last weekend was the big maple syrup outing on Saturday at Poinette.
Oh, cool. Well,
so there you go. Mike and Holman, we go to you. Hi, Mike.
Yes, I believe I saw a marten about 5 to 6 weeks ago, just after we'd had some fresh snow near Camp McCoy near Sparta. And I was wondering if that is their range and what type of marten it would be.
Well, Mike, excuse me. This is a tricky one. Martens and Fishers, both members of the weasel family, were both reintroduced more or less the same time back in the mid-1900s, and there have been some reintroductions since. But the bottom line is Fishers did really well, martens didn't. And martens are restricted to a couple of fairly small areas in north-central Wisconsin. And it seems to me that Camp McCoy is a bit far south. They don't move around nearly as much as Fishers. They're kind of homebodies. But first of all, I would suggest you check the DNR website and go to the Endangered Resources Division. And I think with a little bit of clicking and looking, you can come up with the current range map for martens in Wisconsin. And they're American or pine martens. There's only one species. There are a number of weasel-like animals, but only one marten. But literally, there are only a few hundred of them around. I think more are being brought in, and there are people working on them now trying to augment their population. But I could be wrong, but I just don't think that they're working that far south or that a marten would have gotten down there. So was the animal you saw in a tree or on the ground?
He was on the ground and fairly large.
Mm-hmm.
I would estimate, although I've never seen a marten.
Cat size?
In the wild, so I'm not sure. Pardon me?
Cat size or bigger?
Bigger than a cat?
Bigger than a cat or cat-sized?
A little, right in there. It would have had to have been a large cat. And of course, it loped. Well, it didn't lope, but it moved like a weasel.
And if I asked you what shade of brown was it, what would you say?
I would say it was a dark brown.
I think it was a fisher.
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't aware that there were fishers. I had thought that fisher was the one that was more rare than
No, the fishers. No. Fishers are actually quite common, and we've been getting increasing numbers of reports, even down here, you know, west of Madison, Columbia County, Governor Dodge State Park. So given the size, the loping behavior, the dark color, I think the odds are much higher that you saw a fisher.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls here. And Dennis and Toma is up next with a question for Scott or comment. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
My question has to do is, where are the turkeys?
Where are the turkeys?
They're everywhere.
Well, apparently they're not in the area that I'm going to be hunting, which is just the outside border of North Fort McCoy. And I've been scouting that area for about 2 weeks now and just driving around and looking at fields. And I have yet to see a turkey in any of the fields out there.
Well, there are a couple things going on, Dennis. First of all, I'm not altogether sure that in all parts of the state the big winter flocks have completely broken up yet. So that it may be that in a given area the turkeys are still pretty concentrated. And once they disperse around the countryside, then the sightings become a little more common. So if you see a turkeys, you see a lot of turkeys, or you see no turkeys. On the other hand, the youth hunt is coming up here, I think, this weekend.
Yeah.
So that they're clearly gobbling and quite active in the southern part of the state. And I think the first zone turkey hunting season opens next Wednesday, the 13th.
That's correct.
So I'm assuming that most of the breakup in the south has happened and that the gobblers are active. I can only say I share your observations. The farm that I've been hunting on for years in Iowa County, where it seemed like, boy, they were just everywhere, as Larry said, the past couple seasons, they've been really thin. Oh. And I think that there are places where the rumor that I heard was that there are still lots of turkeys, first of all. I mean, there should be no concern over, holy cow, the turkeys are disappearing. They're from Lake Superior to Illinois and from the Mississippi to Lake Michigan. So they're all over the place, as Larry said. But there are areas where it seems like that initial kind of flush of turkeys reproducing at random and turkeys everywhere may have just kind of toned down a little bit, and the situation may be stabilizing a little. That may be part of it. Other people blame, and I can't say whether this is justified or not, but it seems like there's a lot more concern lately over coyote predation on a lot of different things.
Especially on eggs. And
yeah, there seem to be lots of coyotes around, so there could be a number of things going on, Dennis, but overall, statewide, there are still a lot of turkeys. Perhaps, go ahead.
Could it possibly be the fickle weather that we have? You know, like today's a beautiful day, sunny up here, and then I don't know what the forecast is for tomorrow, but it seems that we might have one or two days of real nice weather, and all of a sudden it turns to the opposite, where it gets very cold and damp, and therefore the turkeys are, as you say, are still grouped together, and they're staying more in the woods because of the weather conditions? Or?
Well, that certainly should be the case, but crummy spring weather, you know, late snows and cold, wet weather are more of a concern once the hens start nesting and the effect that it would have on the ultimate survival of poults or young turkeys. So it's still a little early to be concerned about that, but certainly, off and on, crummy weather keeps the turkeys, at least maybe from being out in the wide open spaces. So that may be part of it, too. So I'm not sure what to tell you, Dennis. I think it's quite possible that for a hunter who's in an area where I've always hunted in this little opening in the woods, there will be people who say, holy cow, there just aren't that many turkeys anymore, when in fact, overall, the turkeys are doing just fine. And it's the same situation that we hear with the deer situation. You know, there are still lots of deer, but there are certainly individual farms or places where people hunt where deer are darn hard to come by. Yet, overall, the deer herd is doing very well. So same kind of situation. I wish you well. I hope a big gobbler, a 25-pounder, shows up in front of you. There's still some out there, although there may be local spots where they're down a little bit.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Peg in Rice Lake. Well, let's turn to you. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I can barely hear you. Are you going to come in through okay?
I hope so.
Me too. I want to put in a good word for the bears again this year. You can live with bears. The DNR had a flyer out here, I think it was last year. I don't know if it's still around. It said living with bears. Well, I do live with bears, and I've had no problems. For the past 3 or 4 years, I've had at least one female with cubs here every summer. No problems with them either. I tell them, go up the tree, get your babies up the tree, and so help me, they do. It's just really not bad. It isn't like living in a town where we own the place. Now we're deferring to them a little bit. We're saying, well, you own it too, but make room for me. I've got to do this or I've got to do that. It can be done. I try really hard not to get them too tame, because I know that would be to their disadvantage. They'd scare somebody else who'd pop them off with a gun, I'm afraid. But I haven't needed guns. I haven't needed anything except my voice, and I talk in a conversational way. And I once taught them to stay away last year from my garbage can, which didn't have a whole lot in it, though, by just simply training them like saying, no, no, no. And I think if I had a bear come too close to me, I'd say the same thing. Just no, go back.
Well, what do you think about that, Scott?
Well, I think we've talked to Peg about this before, and I'm pretty sure my answer will be the same, and that is that you know, Peg seems to understand bears and has come to a meeting of the minds with bears, which is fine, but the DNR publication or the USDA Wildlife Services publication, there are lots of Living with Bears websites and publications around the country. And the reality is that these are big, powerful animals, and at certain times of the year, and they just come out of hibernation, and they're hungry and crotchety, or a female has cubs, that the average person who doesn't live with bears on a daily basis needs to be a bit careful. And therefore, I think the publications and the websites have a place, and people need to pay attention to them. Yeah. And, you know, I guess I'd only point to the – there have been several instances where well-known – one case a photographer and another case a biologist literally living with bears ended up
eaten by bears.
Eaten by the same bears. Now, that's not – that's an unusual circumstance, but it simply conveys the notion that someone who has actually lived literally inches from them and has complete faith in them, that things can go south in a hurry. Yeah. And that's what people need to be aware of, that they are big, wild animals, and they should be treated as wild animals and respected as such. Read the literature and be careful, including Peg.
There you go, Peg. Peg, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We've got a question about wolverines. There was a PBS special on wolverines in Glacier National Park, and Anna in Fall Creek wondered if there were any in Wisconsin. I don't believe there are.
No wolverines. No. Were wolverines.
There were.
A century ago, but they were extirpated, and they're one of those animals that there really hasn't even been any meaningful discussion about trying to bring back, whereas we've restored fishers and trumpeter swans and elk and so forth. Not much talk about wolverines. So
okay,
there have been a couple sightings, but they've all been traced to game farm or animal farm animals.
Mary in Appleton, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
A couple weeks ago, about a month ago, my car was in the garage and not driven for a whole week. And in that week, the mice that occasionally run around our garage apparently decided to go into my car. I put out decon in my car and have done away with two mice. But now I'm wondering, what can I do to stop them coming into my car? And if I leave decon in my car, is that drawing them into my car?
Well, Mary, I mean, for one thing, there are a number of rodents that will occupy parts of a car, either get into the compartment and actually, you know, make a nest or burrow into the fabric or the seats. There are others that will get into the engine housing and chew on the wiring and assorted other things. But part of that is due diligence if you can. Now, if you're gone on vacation, there's not much you can do. But, you know, periodically start the car or check things out, or a car in storage should be checked out. And I think that the use of decon is a little bit problematic because it takes 5 or 6 days for the decon to actually do in a mouse. As opposed to, let me put it this way. When I store my boat or a car for an extended period, I set 4 or 5 mouse traps where I know where they are, and then those provide you immediate feedback. You know you caught the mouse. The mouse is now dead. You can remove it from the boat or car. Whereas with decon, you're really lucky if you actually find the mouse, and worse yet, you may poison a mouse that's burrowed into the seats or something, and then you've got a real odor problem and a maintenance problem on your hands. So I think the traps might be better serve you, or the fact that rodenticides like Decon and some others come in little plastic pouches called place packs that you can distribute in the car, under the seats, or in your boat or whatever, and the rodents will only chew in them if they find them and then can chew through them and utilize or eat the rodenticide, as opposed to just, you know, sprinkling something out in an open bait tray or sprinkling it loose. And other than that, I would, in the garage, that's really the key, is trying to keep them out of the garage. And there, a trap line or your bait stations will intercept them before they get into the car. And that's probably the best bet.
Well, and we also have two cats, and we occasionally let them roam around and stay in the garage. But that wasn't something I wasn't going to let them stay in my car.
Well, that's up to you.
That is up to you,
that's
Mary.
That's up to you entirely.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network as we talk with him about the world of wildlife. Scott, before we go back to the phones, I did want to talk about nature mappers. That's something that you've been visiting about a little bit, know a little about, and I wanted to have you mentioned that.
Yes, the nature mapping whole kind of thing started in the state of Washington about 17, 18 years ago, and a dozen states, including Wisconsin, have started up their own programs. The Wisconsin Nature Mapper program is run. It's a citizen science program run out of the Beaver Creek Reserve up near Eau Claire in Fall Creek. Anyway, near Eau Claire.
Yeah.
Anyway, that started in 2003, and there are currently almost 900 people participating. And the idea here is that people observe all sorts of stuff that's going on outside. They see a new bird, or they find some tracks, or hear frogs calling, or wolf sightings, or whatever. And they can log into Nature Mapper and record these sightings. And this information is then a database for professional managers or amateurs or whoever is interested. So you can find out what's going on in your area or actually contribute information to it. So it's a pretty neat thing to check out. I think the website is still, if I have that here, wisnatmap.org, WISNATMAP.org, but I think if they Google it, they can find it too. And you can decide if you want to participate. But the bottom line is, each month, for a while here, we'll see how this goes, the various 900 people around the state are going to submit a question or two that's on their minds for us to deal with, much the same as folks email in their questions. So I have two quick ones this morning.
One comes from
Sue in Colfax, and it talks about her observation of a couple of ravens pulling bark and wood fibers off a broken tree and then flying away with the wood fibers and then later getting some broken branches. This was back in mid-February. So the question is it possible the ravens were nesting that early? And then when would their young hatch? And the answer is, in Wisconsin bird life, ravens are classified as an unusually early nester, with, I think, the first nest records like the 15th or 16th of February. So, Sue, it's likely those birds were gathering nesting material, and if the snow's got everything else buried, the only game in town is to strip bark or break your own twigs off. So that's what they were doing, and the incubation period's about 19 or 20 days, so whenever the eggs were in fact laid, roughly 3 weeks or a little shorter later, there would have been baby ravens. And the other question actually had this neat picture, which, of course, the listeners can't see, but Larry can describe.
A white-footed black squirrel.
With a bright white tail. It's a really cool-looking squirrel. And the question, of course, and this one came from Joe in Chippewa Falls. It's really a neat squirrel picture.
It's really pretty.
You know, we've, over the last, it's probably been 3 or 4 years now, we've just been besieged by photographs and accounts of weird-colored squirrels. And I've tried to track this down with museum people and squirrel people, and nobody comes up with much of a satisfactory explanation. except that for whatever reason, there have been a lot of aberrant squirrels around lately, you know, from white to black and shades of brown and half white and half brown and half black and half white and all sorts of things like this one. And no good explanation. We knew all along that gray squirrels come in several color phases. You can have jet black ones, snow white albinos, the golden yellow squirrels, mm-hmm. and all sorts of permutations in between. So whatever's happening is happening. So that's a neat squirrel, Joe. Thanks for sending it in. Thanks for the people who are participating in Nature Mapper, and maybe some more will get involved.
Absolutely. Let's go to Linda in Elkhart Lake, who's been waiting a while. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have... I almost stepped on a couple snakes outside my apartment door. It's a ground floor apartment in the village of Elkhart Lake, and there's a hole under the laundry room where we think the I think the snakes wintered. And I don't know. Someone said there were four of them one day, and they were in a pile one day. And call a DNR to get rid of them, or how can we get rid of them and cement up that hole, or would that insulation stuff that you can buy in hardware stores be good enough to keep them from going in there? Or?
Okay, let's take this one step at a time, Linda. First of all, a hole like that undoubtedly leads into who knows what, a crawl space, a fracture in the foundation, a wall void, something.
It's a cement floor.
Okay, well, there's probably a gap or something under there, and these are likely garter snakes.
Yep. No, they're grass snakes. They're green. They're green. They're not black and yellow.
Oh, they're bright green.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, those are smooth green snakes. Those are really cool. Well, either way... Well, you might actually find that, you know, depending on where you are, I would call the DNR office just because smooth green snakes are not that easy to get a hold of. They are pretty little things. They're brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant emerald.
You know, I kind of made friends when I'm looking at them, you know, directly.
Well, they're perfectly harmless, and they're not all that much bigger than a big nightcrawler, so they're not really anything to worry about. But I understand people.
These are at least 2 feet long.
Okay, well, they're good sized ones then. But the bottom line, whatever they are, that's a hibernaculum. It's where they spend the winter. They may gather from quite a large area around and go to that specific hole, and who knows how many are in there. I mean, there could be...
We weren't bothered with them other years. I've been living here for 6 years or
something. This is the first year you've noticed them.
Last year I saw a snake go in there, and that was the whole start of it, I think.
Okay, well, all right. Then the good news is perhaps it's a new hibernaculum and there's only a handful of snakes, but an established hibernaculum could have hundreds and hundreds of snakes.
Oh, my God.
No, don't panic now. This is probably just a few snakes, and it's an unusual variety of snakes, assuming they're smooth green snakes. But anyway, the upshot of it is they come out of the hibernaculum in the spring, disperse around the countryside again to reproduce and do their thing for the summer. So seal it. Give them a few weeks. Wait until we have sustained warm weather. And then kind of keep an eye on the hole. And after you go a week or two not seeing any snakes, no snakes, weather's warm, then go ahead and plug up the hole. And if you, my suggestion would be that expandable foam insulation that you mentioned, one of the common ones is great stuff, but there are others. Spray some of that down there, let that harden and seal up, and then put some heavy landscape rock or something around there that they'd have trouble getting through, and that should be the end of it. Hopefully they'll find another suitable hibernaculum, because they really are not going to cause anybody a problem except for the shock value of having them coming out of the hole.
So there you go. Good luck.
You should be able to solve that with no harm to either you or the snakes.
So, but just wait a few weeks yet.
Wait.
All
yes.
right. There you go. Joe and Wausau, we're on to you. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
I wondered what the latest information on the white nose fungus in the bats was, and if you heard anything lately about the vanishing colony disorder of the honeybees.
Well, first of all, as far as white nose syndrome, I give you a little more of an update. There's actually a regional expert talking about the progression of white nose syndrome, particularly in the endangered Indiana bat, at 2 o'clock in my home department, so I'm headed back for that. But in terms of, as far as I know, we've managed to dodge a bullet for at least one more winter here in Wisconsin. It was discovered in Indiana this winter, which is still getting closer yet, and it was discovered in Missouri, so it's not that far away, and it may unfortunately be inevitable, but so far so good for Wisconsin. On the plus front, there were a series of regulatory measures taken by the DNR board to secure caves and mines and other suitable bat hibernacle in the state in terms of movement of equipment, cavers' clothing, cave activities, cave closures, and things like that, a whole package of rules basically designed to slow the spread of white nose syndrome from getting here and then slow its spread if and when it does get here. So there's some good news in the form of a plan when it arrives. And there's some bad news in that it got a little closer, but still not here yet. So
there you
that's
go.
Kind of it. And as far as the colony disorder in honeybees, boy, I was reading something about that the other day, and now I don't remember what the gist of it was. But Phil can cover
Phil's
that next time
on.
He's on.
Yeah, we'll talk about that the next time Phil's on. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Matthew in Madison wonders if you would announce again where the DNR public hearings are on Monday evening. And then he also mentions he heard two loons at 2:40 a.m. on Lake Monona this morning.
Great. The loons are back. That's
that's a lot of
most.
There are a lot of loons on Lake Monona
okay.
right now.
Okay. Well, if you want to see loons, folks, go to Lake Monona. The Conservation Congress hearings are that there's one in every county. In Dane County, for example, it's at Monona Grove High School, I think in the Performing Arts Center or something like that. But the easiest thing to do is go to the DNR website. There's a listing not only of a sample ballot, so you can see all the things that are going to be discussed and what's going to be voted on, but there's also a listing of all 70-some meetings around the state in terms of where they are and directions. So that's the easiest way to find out. But the one in Madison's at Monona Grove.
And we have Allison in Plum Lake next. Allison, hi.
Hi, I am excited because I'm spending some extended time up at my cottage on Plum Lake, where I normally live in Milwaukee. And we used to feed a lot of things when I was up here in the summers as a kid, and I'd feed unsalted peanuts in the shell to chipmunks, and they'd come out and sit on my shoulder while I fed them. And we always had black sunflower seeds out for birds and had a lot more wildlife that we could see because they were always there, but we'd bring them in closer to the cottage so we could see them. So this fall I was feeding deer corn, and I had a salt lick out that was apple flavored, and I'd have like all these deer, 13 deer coming right up to the window. In fact, if I hadn't fed them in the morning yet, they'd come right up to my bedroom window so my dog would bark, and I'd come out and put out more corn. And then I was told by someone at my church, don't feed the deer, you'll just bring the wolves in closer. And the ticks will fall off of their bodies and burrow deep into the ground. And then in the summer, your dog will have all the ground. So I was like, oh, no, I want to encourage as much wildlife as possible to come as close as it can so I can see it. But then I don't want it to end up being unafraid of humans and then getting killed once these deer seasons and other things start. So would you say that I'm okay if I put out unsalted peanuts and if I put out all sorts of bird feed and put out corn, or am I asking for trouble?
Well, Allison, you've opened a real can of worms here. You know, on the one hand, I certainly understand and appreciate everyone's interest in it. We know the wildlife's out there, and it's really cool if you can get them coming out in the open instead of hiding in the bushes, coming right out there where you can see them or photograph them or show them to the kids or whatever. So that's the whole history behind bird feeding, and it's extended to a variety of other things like feeding peanuts to the chipmunks, which is all fine. The deer issue is sort of a special case, though, and in that case, there's ample evidence that feeding deer like that is, while, yes, no question, you can get the deer to come right up to the window and lick the window, that the wolf issue and the ticks, I don't think there's a whole lot of concern there, but the real issue is whether this is a good thing for the deer or not, as you pointed out, in terms of reducing their fear of people, habituating them to people, you know, having them cross roads that they might not otherwise cross to get to the corn, and all sorts of issues like that. Not to mention the problems associated with nutrition and disease transmission and deer movement patterns during the hunting season, a whole host of other things. To maybe put a salt block out kind of on the corner of the property and see deer pass through occasionally visiting the salt block, you know, maybe no big deal. But the routine feeding of large quantities of corn, although I know it's widespread, is still problematic and very controversial. And there will be, we've just been talking about this Conservation Congress hearings, there will be some baiting and feeding questions yet again on the ballot for statewide initiative about whether there's going to be curtailment of feeding, not entirely this time around, but curtailment, I think it's for a period before the deer season, to let the deer somewhat restore normal movement patterns before the actual deer hunting season. So I can't say much, but I don't think you've got much to worry about packs of wolves following the deer up to your back door. And I'm not sure about the ticks, but there are many other reasons, Allison, why you might want to cut back a little bit on the deer feeding.
You know, one of the things that's sort of trendy now among hunters, deer hunters at least, and those who can do it and can afford it and have property, are food plots, actually planting food plots for deer and other animals.
Well, certainly for anyone who has the space on a rural property or a cabin or even home site or whatever, putting in a food plot, and there are all sorts of mixes of materials to be planted, or asking a farmer to leave a couple extra rows of corn or whatever, that natural food source benefits all kinds of wildlife and is also another way to get things in close to see them. And it's at least a little more of a step in the right direction in terms of a natural provision as opposed to simply dumping the food out on the landscape. But overall, feeding mammals is fraught with difficulties.
There you go, Allison. Thank you for calling. I want to give Andrew in Milwaukee a chance to join in. Andrew, hi.
Hello. I was just wondering, I'm kind of an underprivileged young adult. And I'm looking at a career in ecology or helping with protection of nature.
Great.
I was wondering if there are some outlets that I could go to or look at. Obviously, I don't have all the money in the world to go to school. But I would like to know if there are some things that... here down in southeastern Wisconsin, if there are any avenues that I can go to further a career in the field.
Well, admirable comments, Andrew. I wish you well. I would think that there are a couple of things you can do. For one thing, there are a number of facilities. I'm not sure where you are exactly, but the Todd Weir Nature Center in Franklin, I guess, southeast corner of Milwaukee County, has a variety of programs. The Haven Woods Environmental Center has a variety of programs. And there may be a number of others there. My suggestion would be to perhaps contact the local DNR office and see what types of nonprofits or facilities are around you that you can get to. And kind of get to know those people, maybe volunteer your time a little bit and work your way into the loop, so to speak. And then through, if you have access to a computer or can get a hold of one at the local library, there are scads of websites that would provide opportunities for the Retzer Nature Center, by the way, in Waukesha is another big one close by that has lots of programs. And again, through the websites, looking for opportunities or kind of self-taught kinds of programs or nonprofit groups like the Audubon Society chapters that are over there or other such groups. Schlitz Audubon Center. Yeah. I mean, they're just kind of coming into mind now, but there's a bunch of them over there. And I think if you go and find whoever coordinates the volunteer program or the resident naturalist and explain to them what you just did to us on the air, I think they'll find a spot for you. And then if that leads to further education or opportunities, then so much the better.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. That's good to hear. Somebody really wanting to do that. We have Will in New Richmond up next with a question. Hi, Will.
Hi. I've been hearing something in the woods. I heard it last fall, and I'm hearing it again. It's like a single call, and it's like there'll be a few minutes between it, and then it'll do it again. And can you hear me?
Yeah,
we hear you.
Okay. This is what it sounds like.
Ow! Ow!
Kind of, oh, maybe a little lower than that. It's like, just like a single, is it some kind of bird? Or I haven't heard it before.
So it sounds a little like, ow.
Yeah, a little bit, kind of like a cat. Sometimes, at first I thought it was a cat, but then...
could be a cat.
It's like lower than that, though. And I heard it last fall, and I didn't hear it all winter, and now I'm hearing it again. So it makes me wonder if it's some kind of bird or what.
Well, I'm guessing it is, but that I don't have enough to go on there. But again, although we're running low on time, if there's a listener out there amongst the millions of you who that sound resonates with, give us a quick call. It sounds like a bird to me, but you know, there are even some mammals that even a chipmunk makes a single call note, which is often mistaken for a bird.
Oh, and, yeah, it sounds like something kind of in distress or sort of like lower, like, oh, it's not even like that. I wish I could do it better, but it's like just one call and then there'll be a few minutes and then they'll do it again.
Well, all I can, maybe a listener will come forth, but the other opportunity, there are lots of websites where you can kind of scroll through bird songs, like on ebird.org, and sort of if you have a, you know, an hour some night to scroll through some sounds or simply Google, you know, like sounds of nature kind of things and listen to a few things, it might crop up.
Even single note sounds you could.
Yes.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have a caller, Dick in New London, up next. Dick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
A couple things here. Meadowlarks. I haven't seen meadowlarks for years. What is the situation with meadowlarks? And another question, the previous young person that called, talking about what he could do to... Actually, he could go... The Foxville Tech up here in Appleton has a nice program, Wildland Fire... Mm-hmm. Which he could take, probably, and he could work for the Nature Conservancy or one of those, excuse me, organizations such as that, or get experience in doing that.
Nature Conservancy is another good one. And one other opportunity, there are some people working on a Youth Conservation Congress movement here in Wisconsin to get high school age kids involved in statewide conservation affairs. And from Andrew's, from what I heard, he sounds like the kind of a person who would really be a good delegate if a Youth Conservation Congress materializes. So if Andrew's still listening, watch for that opportunity, maybe through your school, or check with the Conservation Congress representative in Milwaukee County, see what you can do there. And as far as meadowlarks are concerned, Dick, you know, like many grassland songbirds, whether it's Dick Sissels or bobolinks or meadowlarks or whatever, they've had a tough go of it the last couple of decades with declining grassland areas. And there are lots of conservation programs for them, but they have been in steep decline. So that perhaps explains if you've lost some of the open pasture lands or grasslands around you, then you lose the meadowlarks as well. So. Anyway.
And Mike left a comment on the Facebook page. Moose, in the status of moose in the state of the Douglas County, there's been some anecdotal reports.
Well, there's still a few moose wandering around that trickle in from the UP, but not very many. But nothing would surprise me. And remember, we had a bunch of emails about the mouse problem.
Yeah.
Just quickly, people were offering up suggestions like fabric softener sheets, moth flakes, and other such things to maybe put in the car. Some of those maybe have a little merit, especially the moth flakes, but you'd then have to be concerned about the odor issue. And again, be cautious with that.
And a cat that eats a mouse that's been poisoned in 5 seconds?
All the stuff that the average homeowner can buy, secondary poisoning risk is mighty low.
Mighty low. Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, will be back the first Wednesday of May. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.